Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of HER2 Low Breast Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Ian Kropp from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component to Dr. Kropp's presentation. To begin, I asked Dr. Kropp to review the assessment of HER2 status and implications for treatment.
I think as originally designed, the HER2 testing, was the goal of that was to separate out the patients who don't benefit from HER2 therapy from those who do. And so it was clearly a dichotomous question. And so therefore, we got a dichotomous answer. In the clinic, you need to know, yes, do I give HER2 therapy or no, do I not? So you needed to have that kind of yes, no kind of answer. And so the HER2 lows, the people with kind of intermediate levels of HER2 expression, were kind of left out. And that was appropriate because the HER2 therapies at the time, which was mainly trastuzumab, and to some extent pertuzumab, don't seem to have much activity in these intermediate levels of HER2. So the HER2 testing was designed to separate out the patients who benefit from those who don't. And so you got a clear yes, no answer, and therefore just two populations. I think what's changed is that now there's pretty convincing evidence that some of these newer, more potent HER2 therapies like trastuzumab deruxtecan and perhaps trastuzumab duocarmazine and these other conjugates have activity even as you go down to lower levels of HER2, levels of HER2 that are lower than what we would consider HER2 positive. So we need to, now that we have a drug that works in that population, we need to be able to identify them.
So, it actually makes me think about the fact that what we've called HER2 positive really is a biomarker for benefit from trastuzumab, and we'll get a little bit into these other agents, but it kind of gets into a question I've asked people many times for many, many years, and I'm kind of like never really understood the answer, which is how does trastuzumab actually work?
Yeah. I think that many people have asked that question, and there are a number of laboratory studies that can identify multiple mechanisms of action of trastuzumab. Originally, it was designed to inhibit HER2 signaling, but it actually isn't so good at that, at least in the laboratory. And it can inhibit the cleavage of HER2 and the kicking off of the extracellular domain of HER2. It can affect the recycling of HER2. But I think what gradually more and more data are supporting is that in addition to some activity against HER2 signaling, some inhibition of HER2 signaling, it has a clear immune component, meaning that it can activate the immune system to target that cancer, both by this mechanism called ADCC, or antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, and by activating cytotoxic T cells to target the cancer. And that's been the sense of over the last few years of probably a good part of how trastuzumab is working. It may explain why the long-term activity of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting seems to be greater than we had originally expected. And that may be because of the immune activity of the drug. It may explain why a lot of the markers for which cancers seem to benefit from trastuzumab and pertuzumab seem to be immune markers rather than HER2 signaling markers. So I think it's all pointing in that direction that these antibodies work at least in part by immune activation.
So can I say that just sort of intuitively, actually, I kind of really wonder why trastuzumab doesn't work in HER2 low. I mean, you have HER2 there. So why doesn't it work? I mean, it's easy to say, well, it's not enough, but I mean, at any other level, does it make anything logical to you?
I wouldn't completely ignore it's not enough argument because, a HER2 amplified cancer has millions of copies of HER2 on its surface, HER2 proteins on the surface, whereas a HER2, 1+2+ has, 50,000 copies, 100,000 copies. So it's not a small difference, even though, when you say 1+2+3+, it sounds like it's, small differences. It's really from a total protein amount, it's actually quite a big difference between a HER2 truly amplified cancer and a HER2, low cancer. So that may be part of it, but there may be other parts that we don't understand yet.
What do we know about the incidence of HER2 low breast cancer, and does it vary based on ER status?
Yeah, so I think that's where we now have pretty good data that's come out in the last year or two, where we're looking at pretty big data sets. And so the prevalence of HER2 lows is overall, if you just, you know, took a basket of 1,000 breast cancers, you know, the prevalence of HER2 low is about 50 to 55%. So it's, you know, at least half of all breast cancers are HER2 low. So it's a huge group. It's more common in the ER positive cancers. It's about 2/3 of the HER2 negative ER positive cancers, and it's about 1/3 of the triple negative cancers. So it's a lot of people.
So, you know, I always reflect back on the last set of satellites we did at San Antonio, because we've been going there for a long time. And we actually did one on ER positive, one on triple negative, and one on HER2. And more recently, I think we're going to need to do 4 or 5 of these, because first of all, now you've got PARP coming through in general on breast cancer. I'm not, you know, that's a big divider right now. But now HER2 low, I mean, this is, I guess, going to be a huge issue for the most common subtype of breast cancer, ER positive, HER2 negative.
Right. And essentially, it's a new subtype. I mean, it's, you know, it's not often that we create a new subtype of breast cancer, but I think we're going to have to start thinking about this as something different. And we got to treat them differently, just like, as you were alluding to, just like BRCA status has created a new subtype of cancers as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, can imagine that if you're treating chronic lymphocytic leukemia and all of a sudden the IGVH mutation status came along, you had to start factoring that. And now you got a different algorithm. But anyhow, one other question before we start diving more into this, just because I am curious about this in general, and I'm not sure how much you get involved with this, but the issue of HER2 beyond breast cancer. And we're going to get into second. Of course, a lot of this is about TDXD, and we know that TDXD causes responses in GI cancers, gastric and colon, mainly overexpression, and then in lung cancer, bladder cancer has HER2. Do you know anything about HER2 low in these other cancers?
I don't. I will admit, I've certainly followed the fact that TDXD looks quite active in these other cancers, even with that don't have as much HER2 overexpression as breast cancer does. But I don't know the gradations of HER2 and whether in those cancers, whether the data would suggest that the activity of TDXD is very dependent on level of HER2 expression.
Well, the other thing is in colon, the main activity or what they're most excited about is HER2 mutant. And I guess you don't have HER2 low and HER2 mutant, right? It's either mutant or not. There's not a HER2 low, and I guess.
Well, so in some cancers, when you have a mutation in HER2, there is an associated overexpression of that.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting.
But it's not. I don't think it's it's necessary, or that it's always seen. There is, as you pointed out, there are some amplifications of HER2, or there's some mutations of HER2 in other cancer types. And it seems like mutations alone also seem to confer sensitivity to some of these conjugates.
I mean, if this really plays out in breast cancer, obviously it'll be gigantic for patients and for research. But I just have this fantasy, maybe it's going to play out in these other cancers.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Yeah. Well, I think it's already starting to play out.
Right, for sure. So anyhow, before again we dive more into the TDXD story, what do we know about prior studies, I guess mainly with trastuzumab and HER2 low? It kind of seems like that didn't work out.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. It really doesn't seem to have activity in the HER2 lows. And a lot of work was done to try to show that because, you know, it was a natural assumption that, well, these cancers certainly have some higher level of HER2 than is normal. Why wouldn't trastuzumab work? But it just does not. And that's been tested in both the adjuvant and the metastatic setting.
And one thing you went through in your talk that I think is very interesting and relevant is, I guess it looks like a TDM1 doesn't have much or any activity in HER2 low. Is that your take?
So, I mean, the data are a little mixed. You know, we've done a couple when the original there, I don't remember there being any study specifically prospectively looking at this question, but when we looked at many of the original HER2 study, original T-DM1 studies were based on local HER2 testing, and we went back and did central confirmation of HER2, and when you looked at those, because of the discordance of those testing, there were definitely cancers that turned out not to be HER2 positive by central testing, and you know, there was a little bit of activity of T-DM1 there, but not a lot. And it's very, you know, all the studies of T-DM1 suggest that its activity is quite dependent on the level of expression of HER2. And as you go down to lower levels of HER2 expression, you get less activity of T-DM1.
So again, before we jump into T-DXd, I've got to ask you a question. As of a few months ago, what is the current approved and standard first-line therapy, metastatic, HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer? Trastuzumab and chemo was the standard, the so-called TOGA trial from like 10 years ago, which just got approved. Pembro, trastuzumab and chemo. So I guess that's not going to happen in breast, although they have this theory that maybe there's an interaction between the PD-1 axis and HER2. Any thoughts that might be the case in breast cancer, incidentally?
Well, so there, you know, we do have data in HER2 positive breasts that there was a randomized trial, a phase two trial of T-DM1 plus or minus a checkpoint inhibitor, which overall was a negative study, but there seemed to be activity in the PD-L1 positive patients. And there is a trial underway now looking at first line metastatic HER2 positive cancers, looking at chemotherapy, HER2 therapy plus or minus a checkpoint inhibitor. So it is being explored. And there are preclinical data saying that a checkpoint inhibitor should be beneficial along with trastuzumab, but you know, we have to wait and see. And in the neoadjuvant setting, adding a checkpoint inhibitor to chemotherapy and trastuzumab did not add anything, and that study was closed.
You know, of course, PD-1 levels and immunotherapy in general is much more active in upper GI cancer than it is in breast. So maybe it's just 1+1. But again, I hear from them that they're all excited that there's an interaction going on. Anyhow, getting back to breast cancer, but you know, these things go back and forth. As I hear stuff from other people, I'm going to tell you some other things I hear from the GI people. We'll get to that in a second. All right, let's talk about T-DXd. I think everybody's familiar with it, but you had some really great animation and graphics talking about mechanism of action. I think is really important in this particular situation. How do you explain to your fellows basically how T-DXd works?
Yeah, so I think there's the basics of an antibody drug conjugate, which is, you know, it's a way to target the delivery of your cytotoxic agent to the cancer cell. You know, the conjugate, because of its trastuzumab component, binds to the HER2 on the surface of a cell. It gets internalized and then releases the payload where it can kill that cell. And what's, you know, unique or what's different about T-DXd compared to T-DM1 is because the linker chemistry is different, the payload molecule can diffuse out of that targeted cell and kill neighboring cells, even when the neighboring cell doesn't have HER2 on it. So I do think that this bystander effect may be accounting at least in part for why T-DXd seems so uniform in its activity. You know, it virtually every patient has some disease control when using this drug, but it's also, you know, a very potent cytotoxic agent. It's got a lot of payload molecules per antibody, so you should be able to deliver a lot of the payload molecules per each cancer cell that the conjugate binds to. So I think it's probably multifactorial why we're seeing such high levels of activity with this drug compared to the previous generation conjugate.
One of the things in your diagram, though, was the, I guess, the released payload in the cell diffusing out. Does that happen with T-DM1 also? It's just that there's more of it here, or is it there a diffusion issue that it gets out easier?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's a central difference. So it does not happen with T-DM1. And the reason it doesn't happen with T-DM1 is because this kind of gets into the weeds a little bit, but when the payload molecule of T-DM1, the DM1, is released, it's still got a lysine attached to it. and lysines are charged. So that charged payload molecule can't get through the membrane. So it's stuck within the cell, trapped within the cell. Whereas with TDXD, the payload is by itself once it gets released. And so it can go through the membrane just like any other chemotherapy can. Now, just to be fair, you know, the fact that TDM1's payload is stuck within the targeted cell does perhaps contribute to the fact that its toxicity is very minimal, because you don't have any released chemotherapy molecules out there, you know, hitting things in a non-targeted way. Whereas with TDXD and with sacituzumab govitecan, you know, some of that payload molecule can leak out and kill neighboring tumor cells, but theoretically can kill neighboring, you know, other cells, normal cells as well. So that may contribute a little bit to its toxicity differences as well.
So going back to the GI people, one very prominent investigator was on a webinar with us recently and was verbalizing a lot of concerns about, quote, chemotherapy side effects that he observes in patients who get TDXD, but I don't know how many patients he's actually treated. They have a lot less experience than you do. He was very discouraged. He thought these people, not so much hair loss, but nausea, GI, et cetera. Do you see more toxicity, you know, classic chemo toxicity with TDXD than, for example, TDM1?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I do think that the experience of TDXD is a little bit more like conventional chemotherapy than TDM1 is. That being said, I think once you recognize the toxicity profile of TDXD, they're typically very manageable. I think what some people get into trouble with TDXD is they don't appreciate that it's got, you know, that it causes nausea in the majority of people. And so you should treat it as a mutagenic agent and start out with, you know, prophylactic antiemetics. And I think so we now use ondansetron in all of our patients when they, you know, from the get-go when using trastuzumab deruxtecan, and that helps reduce the nausea in the vast majority of people. There are a few people who still have nausea despite that, and you can add additional agents, you can add steroids, you can add a aprepitant to do with that. But I think the key, as with any emetogenic agent, is to prevent the nausea in the first place, so you don't get anticipatory nausea when they come back the next time. And if you do that, it tends to be very manageable. You know, you don't get the thrombocytopenia, you don't seem to get the transaminase elevations, it doesn't have some of the other toxicities that TDM1 does. And so I think it just, as long as you get on top of the nausea from the beginning, it usually is quite manageable. There is hair loss where we don't see that with TDM1. And of course, as we talked about earlier, there is this potential for pneumonitis that you just have to watch for.
Hair loss to the extent that you, I don't know if you use cold caps or not, or if you offer them to your patient, but enough hair loss to bring that up?
Yeah. So the problem is, I think the answer is yes. And about, you know, 40 to 50% of people do develop some alopecia with TDXD. The problem is whether cold caps would help. And the issue, and that we're dealing with the same thing with sacituzumab, is that, you know, the idea of a cold cap is that you prevent diffusion of the chemotherapy to the hair follicles while the infusion is going on. The half-life of the drug is very short, so once you only need to chill the scalp for a short period of time, and then the chemotherapy will be washed out. The problem when you have a conjugate is that the half-life is, you know, 3 days, is 4 days, 5 days, 6 days. So you'd have to, you know, the concern would be you'd have to wear a cold cap for, you know, 4 days, 5 days, which obviously is not feasible. So that our group is trying to do a trial where we're using cold caps with sacituzumab to see if they're effective, but there is a concern that they wouldn't be because of the half-life of these conjugates.
That is so interesting. Incidentally, does sacituzumab have any, I guess you wouldn't know if it has any evidence of bystander effect, or do you?
It does. I mean, it has, I mean, at least preclinically, it has bystander effect. It's all about the linker chemistry.
I keep hearing people responding with triple negative to SASI. Are you seeing a lot of responses?
Yeah, no, it's definitely an active drug. I mean, the ASCENT data are pretty convincing. And that was pre-treated patients. So yeah, it's definitely an active drug. We definitely see responses. And you know, so it wasn't, it wasn't approved based on a fluke. The data looked pretty good.
So one other general TDXD question, and then we'll move into some of the data is, you know, obviously one of the big concerns about the drug has been the interstitial lung disease that's been observed. I'm wondering if you have any update on that. And now you're seeing, we know there's a press release out there, positive in second line. Now, who knows, maybe it's going to be expanded to 50% of breast cancer. Where are we today in terms of interstitial lung disease?
Yeah, so I think the hope, and some of the press release did mention that there was less ILD. Certainly there were no fatal cases of ILD, I think, mentioned, observed in that study. So I'm hoping that that's because we are now recognizing it earlier and treating it earlier. And there were some reason to believe that in less pretreated patients, so as you move it up in the line of therapy, that there will be less pneumonitis. And we, you know, we see that with other drugs as well, that, you know, if in the heavily pretreated patients, there's already presumably some damage to the lung, and that it, then that precipitates the pneumonitis when you come in with a conjugate. So in less pretreated patients, hopefully the hope was that we would see less pneumonitis, and perhaps that's what the data are showing. And I think we're all now used to using it. We all recognize this toxicity. And just like we did with checkpoint inhibitors, it took us a while to learn how to deal with the IR-related toxicities. And I think the same thing is true with this. It just took a little time. So it's certainly something we have to be aware of, but I think we're learning how to manage it better. And I think that's going to make a big difference.
I mean, a lot of things in oncology cause pneumonitis too. So I don't know if they're kind of going to come together and maybe not be any different than a lot of other drugs. We'll see. So let's talk about the evidence that we have right now in terms of activity of TDXD and HER2-low and a couple other antibody drug conjugates that aren't approved, but we have some data on. What do we know about this?
You know, so far, for TDXD, we have one phase one study that had a cohort of about 50 patients. And in that trial, in this HER2-low cohort, the response rate was about, 37%. And that was about the same whether you were HER2-1 plus or 2 plus. And the progression-free survival was 11 months. And these were pretreated patients. So I think that was pretty encouraging. It's not quite the same as we saw with the HER2 amplified cancers where the response rate's over 60%. But it's certainly, very robust activity. And I think would make if that bears out in the randomized trial, I think that would make a real difference, in the course of these patients with HER2-low disease. So I think, that question is now being addressed in a randomized trial, that's been completed, the DESTINY-Breast04 trial. So we'll wait for those data to mature to see whether TDXD is better than chemotherapy in that patient population. There's an earlier line of therapy trial also going on. So that's the story with TDXD. It's not, 1,000 patients of data yet, but in those 50 patients, it certainly looks encouraging.
And what about other antibody drug conjugates? Or you mentioned in your talk trastuzumab duocarmazine. What's that?
Yeah, so this is another interesting conjugate, and it's the first one that we've seen in a while that uses an alkylator payload. We've had several conjugates using microtubule inhibitors, and now we have, sacituzumab and TDXD using topoisomerase inhibitors. So this uses an alkylator. The data in HER2 positive disease looks encouraging, response rates in the high, in around 33%, I think. And now in their phase one, they also had a cohort of HER2 low cancers, and they saw response rates in the 30s to 40% range in that population as well. So, we've heard a press release saying that their phase three trial in the HER2 positive patient population, that's the TULIP trial, was positive. We haven't seen the data yet. I assume we'll see it sometime this fall. And I don't know what their development plan is for HER2 lows, but I would hope that it would, that they would explore this, this population as well. What's interesting about these conjugates is, they're essentially just ways of delivering chemotherapy. So if you can swap out a different chemotherapy payload, there's no reason to think that a cancer that progresses on, you know, a microtubule inhibitor payload conjugate won't be sensitive to an alkylator payload or a topo, you know, one inhibitor payload. So, you know, hopefully you can imagine a situation where you can just kind of rotate these different ADCs, each with a different kind of payload, and keep getting benefit each time.
Wow. Amazing. So where is that going to fit in?
That's a harder question. I think we'll have to see how the data look. You know, but it's, you know, depending on how active it would be, it's still going to be in that same group of drugs that are in the third or later line of treatment, which is, you know, T-DXd and tucatinib and margetuximab and neratinib. And this will just be one more. And where it fits in the pecking order will probably be at least partly determined by how their data look. But as we also mentioned, the second line T-DXd trial, which looking at T-DM1 versus T-DXd was also just announced that was a positive trial, meaning that T-DXd was superior to T-DM1. So it's possible that T-DXd could move into the second line setting and again shuffle everything around.
Right, and I see too with this trastuzumab duocarmazine ocular toxicity. We've heard about it in other ADCs that outside of breast cancer. Belantamab and myeloma is one example. A lot of patient concerns about that. What do they see with this? Same kind of corneal stuff or what?
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's a potential liability for all antibody or for most antibody drug conjugates. Many of them see a little bit of ocular toxicity in their preclinical studies. And even T-DM1, you know, there's a decent number of patients who get dry eye and other kind of more annoying and less serious toxicity from these. But with this one, with duocarmazine, it's a bigger problem. It's the major reason that patients have to dose reduce or discontinue the drug. And it's a whole range of different, you know, corneal and other, you know, annoying, potentially or bothersome side effects. So I know that they've done a lot of work on eye drops and other ways to try to mitigate this. And I don't know. We'll have to see in their trial how well those worked.
There's one for cervical cancer called tisotumab vedotin, and they use ice packs on the eye. Same thing as with alopecia. They say it works, but anyhow, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, just during the infusion too, which is interesting given what you were saying before.
Right.
But they say it works anyhow. And then also RC48-ADC looks like another ADC that works with HER2 low, huh?
It does seem that way. And they also showed some good data. I mean, it's a relatively small number. This is a microtubule inhibitor payload. But you know, has activity in the HER2 positives and HER2 lows in their first trial. And, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out as well.
So another agent you mentioned, I hope this gets approved because I think this is maybe my favorite name for a generic drug, zenocutuzumab. I mean, it's just good. I love the whole idea of bispecifics. Anyhow, of course, we're hearing about that all the time with immune strategies, particularly in heme. What about this one? It's bispecific to HER2 and HER3. Interesting.
Yeah. So the idea there is that it is that one arm binds to HER2 and the other arm binds to HER3 and keeps the two HER2 or the keeps the two molecules from interacting and dimerizing, and therefore this one is really designed both to inhibit signaling, so inhibit that HER3 signaling, as well as activate the immune system. It's actually got a modified Fc portion, so it should generate more ADCC. So it's a really interesting, I agree with you, it's a really interesting idea. In truth, you know, my take on their data doesn't look very impressive. You know, they have very few responses. They're and only a clinical benefit rate was about 17%. What they did, the way they did their trial was they took patients who were progressing on a CDK4/6 inhibitor and some endocrine therapy, and they allowed the patients to continue whatever that endocrine therapy was, and they just added this bispecific antibody. So the idea was, could this bispecific antibody reverse the resistance to endocrine therapy? So it's a big ask, you know, as opposed to switching to a different endocrine therapy. And, you know, the data look pretty modest in terms of activity, but it's an interesting drug. And so, as I mentioned before, you know, there may be other ways to combine it with, you know, agents that makes it more helpful.
I'm just going to ask, I know this is a very naive question, but I'm sure people are thinking about it because we keep hearing about, again, the immune bispecifics and how they cause cytokine release. And the same thing that you see with CAR T. I'm assuming this type of bispecific doesn't.
Yeah, because this isn't bringing in, T cells. This is, you know, both of the arms of the antibody are attaching to the HER2 positive cancer cell. So this one seemed remarkably well tolerated.
So before, I would like to hear about, you know, your case of a patient who was treated. But before we get to that, it seems like, particularly, who knows, maybe there's going to be a difference between 1+ and 2+. But just even to identify the 1 and 2+, you know, in terms of inter-observer variability that you just see with IHC in general, we had a case the other day where somebody misinterpreted an IHC and the patient was MSI high, not breast cancer, but... you know, really scary. But, you know, we know for so long that IHC is not a perfect assay. Seems like there's going to be a strong need to really have a better way to get this, not to even mention the issue of heterogeneity, which I want to ask you about in a second. But what is being done right now in terms of maybe making this more automated or standard?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that it's a, you know, we can't fool around with this now that we have, you know, presuming that we're going to have drugs that are really going to be beneficial for the patients who are HER2 low. We need to be able to identify them accurately. And I know that they're working on trying to come up with good, companion biomarkers to be able to conclusively, you know, identify the HER2 lows. I don't know exactly what methodology that they're exploring, but I know that they've been working on it, and I'm sure there are, and as I mentioned in my talk, there's a group led by David Rim, who's been working on quantitative immunofluorescence, which is more linear than IHC, that's been working on that for a long time. So I think it's something that there right now there's a vacuum, and it needs to be, you know, we need to come up with an assay that we can rely on.
So, you know, there have been so many recent outside of breast cancer positive IO adjuvant trials that I'm thinking about doing a multi-tumor meeting on adjuvant therapy, because there's so many new adjuvant trials coming out. And I just sort of had this fantasy that it's 5 years from now and maybe we're using adjuvant TDXD or another ADC adjuvant. Any thoughts about, do you think maybe we're going to land there?
I think there's a very good chance of that. You know, when you have a drug that has, you know, a 60% activity and a 20-month progression-free survival in seventh-line metastatic, it's hard to believe it's not going to be, you know, even more effective in, as you move it up into less pretreated patients. So, you know, there is a randomized adjuvant registration trial going on right now with TDXD.
Really? Wow.
It's specifically in patients who have residual disease after neoadjuvant treatment. So you remember there was the Catherine trial that randomized patients to T-DM1 or trastuzumab, showing a big benefit to T-DM1. So this is the same idea, now randomizing T-DM1 versus TDXD.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, given its efficacy in the metastatic setting, I would not want to sell it short in the early disease setting. I think it has a very good potential for being really effective there.
Well, you know, think about it. I mean, in the Catherine study, you had an extra 50% hit there, and yet, you know, TDXD might be better. Maybe that's going to bring. Maybe we'll be using it in people with path CRs. Who knows?
I think that's a very astute point in that, you know, those trials were designed, you know, to try to show a good signal. So they looked at the highest risk patients, but we have no data that past CR patients don't benefit from those drugs. And, you know, some of them still recur. It's just a question of their, you know, does the benefit outweigh the risk, knowing that that most of the past CR patients do very well these days. So you'd have to figure out some other way of identifying the PCR patients who are at higher risk for recurrence. And that's where maybe some of these, you know, liquid biopsy approaches could work. You know, I'm hoping that that's really going to help us identify, distinguish the higher risk people in general from the lower risk people by looking at ctDNA after surgery.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I meant to ask you the last thing I was going to mention about other tumor types in HER2. Again, the GI people, they use a lot of liquid biopsies, and they stop using HER therapy. They start at HER positive, then they do a liquid biopsy, and they have no active tissue that says HER2, and the liquid biopsy is negative. They don't treat. And yet I go to them, well, that's not what the breast cancer people do, but do you think we're going to be in a situation, because also there you have the issue of heterogeneity. I don't know if they say there's more than with breast cancer. But what is the role of repeat biopsy in general? What about liquid biopsy? And we're going to get into your case in a second. I've heard a bunch of cases like this where the patient started out positive, maybe borderline positive, then a repeat was negative. And then the doc said, oh, I saw this great data with HER2 low. I'm going to treat, but we'll get, you know, be able to access it by sending to the insurance company the HER2 positive test. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, there definitely is more heterogeneity in the gastric cancer. It's just a different biology there. So, I could imagine that they could select for the HER2 negative cancer cells pretty easily and therefore lose benefit of HER2 therapy. It'll be interesting to see whether they use that same type of approach now that, you know, T-DXd is available, which, you know, is not as, probably isn't as specific for a highly HER2 positive cell. There still may be benefit for T-DXd in those gastric cancers, even if there is some heterogeneity. But you're right. In breast cancer, we've tended to continue to use HER2 therapy in those cases where the HER2 status becomes a little ambiguous, partly because we have a lot more HER2 therapies than the GI people do right now. But it's a messy biology and these treatments definitely can select for HER2 negative cancers. And I think there is a role for doing biopsies in the metastatic setting. Whether we can, use circulating tissue as a way to not have to do invasive biopsies over time, I think is something that time will tell, but certainly the technology keeps getting better and better. So I wouldn't be surprised if we can do most things by liquid biopsy, in a few years.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is the case that you presented before that we were talking about, a 50-year-old woman who initially started out in 2013, T3N0, ER positive, technically HER2 positive.
She was HER2 positive, yeah. I mean, yeah, she was technically HER2 positive.
So patient starts out HER2 positive, but borderline positive, gets adjuvant chemo, trastuzumab. So then goes on hormonal therapy, and then in 2019 presents with a cough, bilateral lung lesions, bone lesions, and adrenal met. Adrenal met's positive, but now the ratio, FISH ratio is 1.8, the HER2 is still 2+. She goes on what most women go on in that situation, CDK, AI, and ZDA. But gets worse, increase in lung lesions, hepatic lesions. And maybe you can talk about, this patient, I guess, would be looking at chemotherapy in this situation. And without any other new options, what would you be thinking about her life expectancy at that point?
So for this particular patient, since she did have some benefit from her CDK inhibitor, we did try one additional line of endocrine therapy. I don't know if you had mentioned that. We did try fulvestrant and everolimus, but that, you know, that showed no efficacy. And then we're switching to chemotherapy. I don't have in my head a statistic for what the overall, the median overall survival is for a particular patient like this who's had very little benefit from their second line endocrine therapy and starting chemotherapy. It's hard to use a one number for breast cancer because it's, you know, because there are so many different, you know, types of breast cancer situations with different levels of ER and different grades. And, you know, the biology is just, you know, quite varied. But I think what was concerning about this particular patient is that we did switch her to chemotherapy. We used capecitabine, which is what I think many of us, certainly what I do a lot in first-line ER-positive disease. And she had no benefit. I mean, she progressed instantly on that. And then we switched her. Actually, we only used that one line of chemotherapy, but because she had so little benefit, it made me anxious. And again, because she was HER2 positive at one point, it allowed us to use trastuzumab deruxtecan, and she had, still is having ongoing benefit from it. You know, I think in this case, I felt very justified in using it because she'd had borderline HER2 status all along, and we had already had the data from Dr. Modi showing, you know, benefit in HER2 low cancers. I think the harder point is the patients with HER2 that, you know, clearly repeatedly HER2 low cancer. We don't have compelling data yet. We don't have randomized data yet showing benefit, and it's not FDA approved in that situation. So what we do in those patients is a little harder yet. Hopefully we'll have data soon.
How did she, we were talking about side effects from T-DXd, how did she do?
I mean, she did what I think is pretty what we commonly see, which is she did have some nausea. It only lasted for a few days. It seemed to have responded to ondansetron. I didn't escalate her anti-nausea regimen because she felt it was very manageable and she knew it was going to go away in a day or two. And other than that, she did not have alopecia, and she continues to work. And so she finds it pretty easy.
Was she symptomatic from the disease when she started treatment?
I'm trying to think, because it was a year ago. I mean, when her cancer was acting up, her cough seems to get worse. So that's always been a hallmark for when we needed to scan her. So my recollection was that that's what happened this most recent time. And her, now her symptoms, she's definitely asymptomatic now. And her, you know, her scans show a pretty significant improvement. She still has some pulmonary lesions you can see. But she's not now asymptomatic. She really doesn't have any symptoms from her cancer. Feels like she's in a good place.
So I know there's a couple of phase 3 trials cooking, looking at this question, and I think probably anybody who's listened and watched what you and I have been talking about today is going to say, I sure hope we see that soon.
Yeah. I don't know when the first study, which is the one, the DESTINY-Breast04 trial, which is the one in patients who've already received chemotherapy. I don't know when that's planning on reporting, but I assume it should be pretty soon because it's been closed for a while. I think it's going to be very, if it is a positive trial, it's going to have a huge impact because, as you said, it's a very common situation. These are very common cancers, these HER2 low disease patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Kropp, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.